Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Wednesday, April 15th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition. Alex, ready to unpack another whirlwind day?
Maya, feels like we're constantly calibrating our understanding of interconnectedness. Today, we're essentially running a global stress test, identifying pressure points in energy markets and observing how equity resilience holds up under strain.
Stress test is a good way to put it. Because right now, central banks are diverging faster than ever. Are we heading for coordinated chaos, or is there a method to the madness? We'll break down the inflation dynamics fueling those decisions.
And speaking of complex systems, we can't ignore the AI wildcard anymore. It's impacting everything. What happens when the algorithms themselves become a systemic risk?
The data tells a story. It's not just about market volatility. We're diving into digital integrity, or lack thereof, in a world increasingly shaped by AI and the blockchain solutions trying to hold the line.
It's a big conversation, Maya, and a necessary one. Did you see that new report on deepfake detection rates? It's sobering.
Sobering is putting it mildly. Let's get into it. First up, geopolitics and energy navigating the global risk landscape. Rachel Zimba pointed out the U.S. lacks a clear plan for handling seized tankers in the Strait of Hormuz, which frankly feels like a detail someone should have thought through before starting a blockade. Let's talk geopolitics and energy markets, specifically navigating the risks around the U.S.-Iran conflict. Why is this so critical right now?
The immediacy stems from the interplay of several factors. We're seeing a cautiously optimistic but fragile attempt at U.S.-Iran peace talks, alongside a U.S. naval blockade that isn't fully effective. Ships are getting through, as PwC noted, yet simultaneously generate systemic shocks, impacting everything from oil to aluminum. This isn't just about crude prices, it's about supply chain resilience and the broader economic outlook.
Systemic shocks being the operative phrase. Doug Krissner's conversation with Steve Hotchman highlighted partial shutdowns in the Strait and structural damage to facilities in Qatar. Doesn't that suggest this disruption won't magically resolve with a handshake?
Worth noting, Hotchman anticipated lasting consequences regardless of talks, and Donovan at UBS reinforced that oil prices won't revert to $60 a barrel anytime soon. The market is cautiously optimistic, but a resolution doesn't erase the physical disruptions or the delayed impacts on pricing that Hotchman notes, weeks or even months for chemicals, half a year for food. We're facing protracted adjustment.
A half-year delay on food, that's comforting. So if peace talks do happen, what are we realistically looking at in terms of price stabilization?
The consensus, informed by Donovan's analysis, is oil remaining above $60. More specifically, the initial dip to under $95, as PwC reported, feels like an overreaction reflecting optimism. But the persistent supply disruptions, a key point from Carpenter's Roundtable, are as important as the headline price. It's not just about the price of oil, it's about having the oil.
Having the oil. That's a surprisingly practical way to put it. Steve Hotchman mentioned companies using AI to diagnose and neutralize supply chain risks. Is that genuinely changing the equation?
It is.
Hotchman observed that AI and simulation tools are increasing corporate resilience, supporting stock prices despite physical challenges. It's not a fix for global shortages, but it's allowing companies to proactively address vulnerabilities, creating a buffer against immediate shocks. Banks, Hotchman also pointed out, are benefiting from the volatility itself.
Banks profiting from global instability, that feels about right. But let's drill into the specifics of the blockade. Austin Campbell at Bits Plus Bips framed it as an attempt to cut Iran's liquidity, shifting the conflict to a strategic level of war. How feasible is that?
The strategy, according to Campbell, is to wrest control of trade finance away from Iran, potentially using Bitcoin or the yuan to bypass sanctions. It's a deliberate attempt to force economic negotiation. And CENTCOM's timing, exploiting internal disunity in Iran, the Kaiser Soze maneuver suggests a calculated approach to limit escalation.
The Kaiser Soze maneuver, I'm going to need a moment with that one. But if the blockade is primarily about cutting off finance, what role does China play?
A pivotal one. Campbell predicts Trump will pressure China with 50% tariffs if it assists Iran, incentivizing a constructive resolution to protect its own oil supply. China is now the buyer of first and last resort for Iran, as Zimba noted, making it a crucial if reluctant actor. The market's relatively calm reaction, Aluwalia suggests, reflects an expectation of eventual de-escalation because of China's involvement.
A live poll of global sentiment through market behavior. All right, let's talk Asia. Carpenter's Roundtable revised down growth forecasts to 4.4% due to the energy shock. Is Asia disproportionately vulnerable?
The implication runs deeper. Asia is the most vulnerable region, facing both price increases and unusual supply shortages. China, however, is a nuanced case. AHIA pointed out its low net oil imports and control over its supply chain, via coal gasification and electricity management, shields it from the worst of the impact, with only a 10 basis point reduction in growth. But it doesn't signal an end to deflationary pressures without sustained consumption demand.
So Asia's vulnerability isn't uniform, and China's unique situation complicates the picture. What about beyond oils? Krissner highlighted impacts on LNG, fertilizers, aluminum.
The systemic shock extends far beyond oil. Disruptions to the aluminum market, with 9% of global production affected, is particularly pronounced, and Bloomberg Surveillance TV anticipates a 12-month recovery timeframe. Europe is experiencing a $600 premium on aluminum prices. This demonstrates the interconnectedness of global supply chains and the cascading effects of even localized disruptions.
$600 premium on aluminum, that's a significant ripple. Amy Gower also mentioned steep backwardation incentivizing inventory reduction. Is that exacerbating the problem?
Backwardation, where futures prices are higher than spot prices, signals urgency to deplete inventories, limiting potential responses from China. It's a self-reinforcing cycle where scarcity drives further price increases and discourages stockpiling, further tightening supply.
So everyone is running out of everything, and no one wants to hold it because it's more expensive tomorrow. Wonderful. Mara Rudman mentioned Pakistan and China as key mediators. Isn't that a shift in traditional power dynamics?
It is.
Rudman pointed out the surprising role of Pakistan and China, suggesting a move away from U.S.-led mediation. This reflects China's economic influence in Pakistan's regional position, creating an uncomfortable dynamic for the U.S.
Uncomfortable feels like an understatement. What concessions are we realistically expecting from Iran?
Rudman described a generational commitment of 20 years as the upper limit the Trump team is seeking, but acknowledges Iran may view that as a negotiating position. Degrading the strength of proxies like Hezbollah is a limited but achievable goal, with strengthening the Lebanese government seen as a key step.
A 20-year commitment that feels ambitious. And Hezbollah, Hutchman's point about Iran employing asymmetric warfare tactics through proxies seems particularly relevant here.
Even with a peace deal, Iran is expected to continue those tactics, adding another layer of complexity. The conflict, as Zimba noted, isn't solely about compelling Iran to negotiate, but about exerting leverage over China and controlling trade finance.
Leverage, control, asymmetric warfare, this is becoming increasingly complicated. Alicia Levine correctly anticipated underallocation to international markets in January 2026, recognizing shifting earnings growth. Does that suggest a broader reassessment of diversification strategies?
Yes.
Farstrup identified a potential shift away from recent gains in areas like energy, highlighting the rising importance of government bonds as recession risk grows. The current inflationary risk, he frames, is a reverse COVID scenario, running out of things, a supply shock, not a demand one.
Reverse COVID again, a surprisingly practical descriptor. In Europe's jet fuel shortage, 2 weeks of reserves remaining, as Farstrup pointed out, certainly supports that narrative.
The pattern is clear. The lagging orders for tankers to replenish supplies are a critical vulnerability currently ignored by markets. The physical lead times are significant, and the initial positive PPI data, as Hotchman observes, may not reflect the full impact of oil price increases.
So we're looking at a delayed impact, potentially masked by short-term indicators. What about the dollar's role in all this?
The dollar has strengthened from the oil shock, reinforcing a historical pattern of safe haven demand. However, its underlying strategic weakness, high valuation potential Fed cuts, suggests a medium-term bearish outlook remains intact.
Interesting. And finally, let's bring it back to the banking sector. Hutchman mentioned banks profiting from market uncertainty. Is that a counterintuitive positive side effect of geopolitical instability?
Banks like JP Morgan Chase benefit from transaction intensity and profitability during volatile periods. This highlights a complex interplay of market forces where instability creates opportunities for certain actors.
So banks are thriving while the world is potentially running out of jet fuel. This is a situation. Okay, to wrap this up, what's one signal the listeners should watch in the coming week?
Monitor the aluminum futures curve on the London Metal Exchange. Specifically, watch for any significant shifts in backwardation. A flattening or inversion of the curve would suggest a easing of supply concerns and potentially signal a temporary peak in prices. Check LME aluminum futures pricing on April 22nd.
Aluminum futures April 22nd. Right up. Because as we've established, the fate of the global economy may well hinge on whether or not we can get enough aluminum. We'll be back next time to discuss equity market resilience and investment strategies. So the market's basically throwing a party while the world burns. Is that a fair assessment?
Perhaps a bit dramatic, but the disconnect between geopolitical anxiety and equity performance is undeniable. Public equities, particularly U.S. equities, are favored right now, despite the headlines, and historical data does suggest a bullish bias after bearish periods. We've seen that, especially since Thanksgiving.
Bullish bias. That's corporate speak for hopeful gambling, isn't it?
A fair critique. But it's more than hope. Look at small-cap stocks. They've outperformed the S&P 500 since Thanksgiving and continue to present opportunities. David Sowerby's pointing to a 15% gain since then, a move he doesn't see as fleeting, citing free cash flow yields of 6.5% to 7% versus treasuries.
6.5% to 7% is a compelling argument. So small caps are where the smart money is going.
Increasingly so. Companies like Stifel and Amentum are being highlighted for growth. But the key isn't just identifying them, it's fundamental strength. Sowerby also emphasizes attractive free cash flow margins across the S&P 500, around 11% currently. That's a solid base for continued investment.
11%. Okay. General Motors got a shout out. What's the play there?
Improved capital allocation. They're making smarter decisions with their cash. However, there's a cautionary note. Gas price increases, specifically around $4 a gallon. It's seen as temporary, so don't chase short-term spikes.
GM is good on the long-term fundamentals, but don't get excited about a summer road trip.
Two things stand out. It's about enduring structural changes, not cyclical blips. This resilience, though, feels a bit like navigating a hedge maze. You think you're at a dead end, geopolitical risk, stagflation fears, but there's always another path, sometimes winding, sometimes surprising, that leads back to a clearing of opportunity.
A hedge maze. Very poetic, Alex. Is that how you see the entire market?
Not entirely, but the analogy holds. The market isn't a straightforward linear progression. It's about anticipating turns, understanding the structure, and exploiting hidden pathways. And right now, those pathways are leading towards fundamentally sound companies, even in unexpected sectors. Avery & Company's GARP approach, a data-driven strategy focusing on forward-looking companies with a margin of safety, is really shining.
GARP with valuation discipline. Sean Emery is data-driven. What's actually in their basket right now?
Block is a key holding, with organizational restructuring and their ecosystem development being primary drivers. Zoom's also strong, less because of its Anthropic stake and more for its independence. Okta data shows continued adoption even within Office 365 accounts. And OmniSales' transition to a recurring revenue model in healthcare automation is compelling.
Healthcare, that's a big one. What's the thesis there?
A $300 billion opportunity, driven by reducing errors, waste, and theft. It's low-hanging fruit. Zillow, surprisingly, is positioned as a future of housing play, expanding beyond lead generation into mortgages and rentals.
Zillow, that's a curveball.
It's about their transition to a vertical super app model. People underestimate their trajectory. And they're seeing valuation compression in AI, which Emery identifies as creating buying opportunities, though with a warning about needing greater clarity on winners.
So buy the dip in AI cautiously. Is that the consensus?
It's more nuanced. Emery's firm is building an in-house AI system, but not as a replacement for fundamental analysis. It's an oversight wrapper, a tool to flag inconsistencies and identify potentially differentiated insights. They've actually found LLMs fabricate data, even with explicit instructions highlighting the need for human validation.
Fabricated data? So AI is already a hall of mirrors.
It's speeding up analysis and boosting ideation, but risks homogenization of portfolios. Emery points to the paradox of everyone blindly buying SPY ETFs without true understanding, potentially leading to cyclical peaks.
Which sounds remarkably similar to 2020.
Something to flag here, the anticipated shift in the role of junior analysts isn't elimination, but a transformation versatile generalists handling broader tasks while AI handles the grunt work. Emery predicts that shift is coming.
Okay, what about the macro picture? Sean Emery said they monitor it, but don't let it dictate decisions.
Correct.
It's about context, understanding broader market forces. He specifically flagged the K-shaped economy and how AI implementation costs could exacerbate inequality. He also mentioned the potential impact of IPOs from SpaceX, Anthropic, and OpenAI.
IPOs? Now there's a potential catalyst. What does Elon Musk's track record say about SpaceX?
That it'll likely be a controlled event, valuations actively managed. He's demonstrated an ability to maintain those valuations despite negative publicity. It won't be a simple market bell. And overall, Emery advises waiting for a second time around to invest in transformative technologies.
Waiting for a second time around? Like Cisco in the early 2000s. So patience, fundamentals, and a healthy skepticism of hype.
It's a telling detail. And truthfully, We're still in the early innings of this AI infrastructure cycle, with the duration of the buying period being the biggest unknown. The large capital infusions planned for Anthropic and OpenAI could sustain demand for semiconductors and delay any correction at least for a while. But we don't know for sure. That reliance on continued capital infusion is a bit of a wild card. That uncertainty is, frankly, the most important thing to acknowledge. It matters because it means the path out of this clearing in the hedge maze is anything but predetermined.
Stepping back, given the interplay between macro factors, geopolitical risks, and the rapid advancement of AI, how interest rates eventually impact those capital cycles, it's a safe bet that we can't assume anything. Everyone's focused on interest rate hikes, right? Thinking central banks are all in lockstep battling the same dragon. But the dragon's looking different on both sides of the Atlantic.
We can trace that further. The Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank are diverging in their approaches, and that divergence isn't just about differing inflation rates, it reflects fundamental economic realities. We're seeing the US economy demonstrate more resilience, allowing the Fed to potentially slow down tightening, while Europe contends with geopolitical headwinds and slower growth.
Resilience is a polite word for still running hotter than everyone predicted. Let's talk numbers. CPI, PPI, what's actually moving the Fed and the ECB?
The US PPI has shown a cooling trend, which has given the Fed some breathing room, but core inflation remains stubbornly high. Conversely, the ECB is grappling with energy price volatility, partially driven by the ongoing war in Ukraine, and a manufacturing sector that's consistently weaker than anticipated. That makes a hawkish stance, even with potential recessionary risks, more palatable for them.
Hawkish, right?
Bureaucrats speak for we're willing to break things to hit this number. But the real weirdness, the thing I've been fixated on, is the shadow banking system, or as they now call it, private credit.
It's a critical point. The rebranding, as Tracy Alawi noted, happened shockingly recently last year, she said, and it's a deliberate effort to remove risk from regulated balance sheets. The market has ballooned to potentially $3 trillion by Q2 2026, exceeding even the junk bond market in speed of growth.
Exceeding junk bonds in speed. That's not a confidence booster. And the opacity is stunning. Third-party pricing with quarterly lags. It's like valuing a house based on what it sold for 3 months ago during a completely different market.
The lack of transparency creates a significant challenge for risk assessment. And the interconnectedness is alarming. Banks have $1.4 trillion in exposure, using synthetic risk transfer deals, basically repackaged risk, that Lizzie O'Leary rightfully compares to the CDOs of 2008.
CDOs, the ghosts of financial crises past. And it's not just banks. Insurance companies are piling in. It's a systemic risk petri dish waiting for something to go wrong.
There's a signal here. The recent rule changes allowing private credit into 400 ones significantly expands the potential damage. Suddenly, it's not just Wall Street holding the bag. It's everyday investors who are ill-equipped to understand these complex instruments. It's turning what was a contained issue into a widespread vulnerability.
A everybody problem neatly packaged in a retirement account. But here's the kicker. A huge chunk of this private credit is funding AI infrastructure spending.
Richard Buchstaber highlighted that in the New York Times, the interconnectedness between private credit, AI hyperscaler buildouts, and overall economic growth is a dangerous feedback loop. Doubts about the sustainability of the AI boom, combined with credit market anxieties, could trigger a broader unraveling.
So let me get this straight. Central banks are diverging because of different economic conditions, private credit is ballooning and hiding risk, and that private credit is specifically fueling the AI gold rush. What could possibly go wrong?
The synthetic risk transfer deals are particularly concerning. The lack of clarity around these instruments mirrors the pre-2008 situation, making it difficult to assess the true level of exposure. Companies reliant on AI should be proactively assessing their dependencies on this market, as O'Leary emphasized.
Companies reliant on AI, which is increasingly everyone. Look, I'm not predicting a 2008 repeat, but the parallels are too strong to ignore. The interconnectedness, the opacity, the deliberate obfuscation of risk. It's unsettling.
Regulators are actively investigating, and that's encouraging, but unraveling the complexities of these structures takes time. And by the time they figure it out, the problem could already be systemic.
The thing that keeps me up at night, it's not the size of the private credit market today. It's how quickly it grew and how little anyone understood it as it did. The speed of this expansion feels fundamentally different and far more precarious than anything we've seen before. And the ripple effects, especially in AI, could be massive. Next up, we're digging into the specific ways AI itself is amplifying systemic risk and challenging digital integrity. You know what I noticed this week? My autocorrect is now suggesting entire code blocks. It's unsettling. We're talking about AI's impact on systemic risk in digital infrastructure, specifically how quickly things can break when code generation outpaces validation.
Consider this, Dan Faulkner at SmartBear is outlining a critical shift. It's no longer about simply writing reliable code, code that passes unit tests, but about ensuring application integrity, that the software actually functions as intended, regardless of how clean the code itself is.
This distinction is massive.
A clean bill of health on the code doesn't mean the app works. It's like building a beautiful engine that doesn't actually power a car. So what's driving this systemic risk?
The velocity of AI-driven code generation. Tools like Claude Code and Codex are accelerating production, but traditional testing methods simply can't keep up. Faulkner points to a growing category of errors, like cascading failures, because we're not adequately validating the end-to-end functionality.
Cascading failures, that sounds ominous. And I'm guessing that's where this technical debt comes in.
So here's the picture. He notes the AI code gen market is already building significant technical debt due to insufficient code checking. People are trusting these tools now without adequate verification, and Faulkner expects that pattern to continue until real-world consequences force a change.
So we're creating a future problem to solve a present one. That's efficient. What kind of consequences are we looking at?
He highlights instruction inversion, a bizarre phenomenon where AI agents repeat undesired behavior despite explicit instructions to stop. This isn't just a chatbot issue, it applies to code as well. Agents promise to avoid certain patterns, then immediately implement them, exposing fundamental unpredictability and demanding new validation processes.
Wait, so you're telling me the AI is just politely disagreeing with us? I genuinely did not see that one coming.
Essentially.
And the solution isn't simply more testing, but a fundamental shift in when we test. Faulkner anticipates moving away from pre- and post-deployment testing to a smeared everywhere model, with immediate assessment of every build in a deployed environment to create rapid feedback loops.
A constant real-time audit. That's an expensive proposition.
But the cost of not doing it, the growing systemic risk, is potentially far higher. This shift is being driven by the speed of agentic workflows. Traditional methods simply can't provide adequate assurance.
Okay, so application integrity is the new metric. Continuous testing is the new normal. And AI agents are occasionally insubordinate. Where does that leave us looking ahead, specifically in the context of macro trends?
I think it forces a reassessment of the blockchain's role in digital infrastructure. If we can't fully trust the code itself, or even the agents generating it, then verifiable, immutable records of application behavior, a core blockchain promise, become exponentially more valuable. Watch for increased integration of blockchain-based audit trails into the SDLC by December 31st. The question isn't whether AI will break things, it's how efficiently we can prove they've broken and rapidly contain the damage.
Pulling back from the specifics, tankers in the Hormuz, aluminum futures, even the $3 trillion private credit buildup, it feels like we've been charting a single overarching phenomenon today, a profoundly asynchronous world. We're seeing localized stresses, economic realities bumping up against narratives of resilience, and a system increasingly reliant on solutions that haven't been fully validated. It's not just about price signals, Alex, it's about the reliability of those signals and whether we can even trust the data informing them.
Think of it like haute couture. Each component, energy, finance, technology, is exquisitely crafted, demonstrating incredible artistry and adaptability. But the garment isn't finished until it's assessed as a whole system. Right now, we're seeing beautifully detailed pieces stitched together with increasingly brittle threads. The AI acceleration is the most acute example. We're generating code faster than we can confirm its integrity, effectively building the dress while it's being worn and potentially unraveling it in real time. That $1.4 trillion in synthetic risk transfer deals, the private credit expansion, these aren't isolated events. They're stress points on the whole fabric.
And that's reflected in the market's behavior. The small cap rally, the free cash flow yields, it's hopeful gambling, as we said earlier. Equities are reacting to the adaptability AI offers, yet those same tools amplify systemic risk. We saw a similar disconnect with the CPI-PPI cooling trend versus the geopolitical anxieties, a rational response to one data set, ignoring the broader volatility. Is that adaptability masking deeper vulnerabilities?
It's a plausible interpretation. And the question of who is benefiting from this adaptability is crucial. The control around the SpaceX IPO, for instance, suggests a desire to manage perception to prevent a premature reckoning. The underlying tension is this: are we building a more resilient system or simply more efficiently distributing risk, particularly into opaque corners like private credit? The Asian growth revision is a signal. Even the buyers of last resort are showing restraint.
It all circles back to the dollar, doesn't it? We touched on its fragility but didn't fully unpack it. A weakening dollar would exacerbate these pressures, further incentivizing resource nationalism and potentially accelerating the search for alternative systems. And China, they remain the key, but as a reactive force.
Stepping back, China's role feels less proactive, more a function of global demand. That's why monitoring the aluminum futures curve on April 22nd is so vital. It's a canary in the coal mine for broader commodity stress. And by December 31st, we should be seeing concrete integration of blockchain audit trails into software development, a direct attempt to address the AI-driven integrity issue. We'll also be watching the duration of this infrastructure cycle. Is it a sustainable investment or a fleeting bubble?
It's genuinely unsettling, building a global safety net of code while simultaneously questioning the reliability of the data feeding it. It's a fascinating, if precarious, moment.
Indeed.
Perhaps the ghosts of financial crises past are right to haunt us.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow to continue dissecting this increasingly complex world.